from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, and today I'm going to cover a number of issues a little bit tied to war, all right, but some of it dealing with some recent terrorist activity we've had here in the U.S. Of course, you know, I've kind of already addressed this. It was pretty fresh. The last STRAT broadcast was talking about the car bombing in Palm Springs at the reproduction center, at the IVF clinic, if you will, where they keep embryos and where they do IVF and a lot of other things. And we didn't know a lot at that time. We didn't know the guy who did it. Now we do. Guy Edward Barkas. He was from 29 Palms, a little bit north of there, very close to Marine Corps base. And it was a very substantial explosive device. I kind of speculated that it was based on what I'd seen, but it was a big, big bomb. In fact, I think it's the biggest bomb we've seen for quite some time, maybe decades, in Southern California. Much bigger than something that hit down in Orange County a while back at a spa. And he had a lot of explosive material that he was working with. And it turns out that he had a background with model rockets and doing stuff with various chemicals tied to that can be basically used normal chemicals you can buy, but they can be converted into explosive devices. By the way, there's a ton of stuff out there that can be commercially purchased, that can be turned into incendiary materials, explosive materials, whatever. If you know what you're doing, and there really isn't a great way to stop that because so much of it is, frankly, just needed for the intended purpose that there's just really no way to prevent that per se. Anyway, he did a lot of damage. He was, this may sound a little odd, anti-pro-life. This is one of the more obscure agendas out there. It was a pro-mortalist, if you will. In other words, he was about killing people and preventing human reproduction, preventing, you know, children from coming into the world. He was an anti-natalist, if you will. He belonged to a very obscure movement. Now, if you go back to the roots of this movement, he didn't particularly appear to be very religious. But if you go back to this movement, there have been some very strange beliefs going back literally 2,000 years. Some of the ascetic Gnostics in the early, first few centuries AD, if you will, had some strange ideas about, in some cases, castrating themselves, but not reproducing and stuff like that. So anyway, that's been out there. If you go to the 19th century, the Shakers movement, which actually was a pretty big movement, was about not having, not having children. Not surprisingly, over time, that movement died out because he didn't have any children. And so anyway, he actually came out from a different standpoint. I think, first off, if you look at it, he had a lot of personal problems, but I will tell you that if you look at the world of terrorism, not all terrorists are well-balanced, stable individuals. In fact, most of them, particularly those that end up killing themselves in the course of their attack, often have a lot of personal issues. This guy was absolutely no exception with that. And not surprisingly, which I speculated on, there was a lot of online activity. He was talking about stuff. He was posting stuff. There was a website which was anonymous. At least it didn't go back to him directly, but they're pretty sure that's him. And he did post a manifesto online. He did all the sorts of things you see. And it goes back that thing I've said in terrorism training for decades, which is before they're acting out in the real world, they're venting like crazy in the virtual world. And this guy was absolutely fit that mold of venting online. You know, one of the problems is when we talk about, quote, law enforcement, unquote, it's not that we don't look at online stuff. And certainly as an investigative methodology, certainly and definitely with things like this, we always look very closely at all their online activity. That is just de rigueur for what's being done. However, patrolling that sort of thing, you know, we will patrol the streets where the person lives, but we're not patrolling the online activity that the person's involved in. And I'm sure there's those out there that say, well, what about free speech and all that stuff? Yes, but if it's publicly available, you know, there's a concept in evidence called plain view. In other words, I can see it. You know, you don't have an expectation of privacy if I can see it. It's right there in plain view. That's the same thing I would say in the virtual world. If it's in plain view, if you're putting it out there in such a way that anybody can see what you're talking about, then it is in plain view. And we've got to do a better job. I know we do a lot of looking at this, and I'm sure there are some back there who say, Hal, you're touching on some programs that we don't want to talk about publicly. But we've got to do a better job picking up on this, particularly on the domestic side. We do a much better job looking at the international side. Certainly, if you look at what happened after 9/11 with Al-Qaeda and some of the other groups, international terrorism, transnational terrorism, stuff like that, we do a much better job. Of course, there are no legal restrictions in terms of privacy rights or anything like that. If it's overseas and there's foreign individuals talking about doing harm to the U.S., there's nothing that prevents us from doing whatever we can, technically speaking, to collect that intelligence of whatever's needed. All right. So anyway, that is who did this thing. They confirmed, FBI confirmed that Barkas had a large amount of explosives. And we can conclude from this that he potentially posed a much greater threat than just this one attack. He was trying to upload. He was trying to actually live stream his attack, not dissimilar from what we've seen with other terrorist attacks. Probably one of the more famous ones was the one in Christchurch, New Zealand, where an active shooter went in and was actually live streaming his entire attack. Well, he was trying to, he'd set up his, I think his cell phone camera or whatever on a tripod and was planning to upload. He didn't get it uploaded. And I am kind of wondering to this day, we may never be able to find out, if that bomb went off a little bit earlier than he expected. There's just some things that would indicate that maybe his timing was a little bit off. He may have been able to build explosives, but, you know, he wasn't a genius at explosives. He didn't have a background in explosive ordnance or anything like that. So he may have been trying to do this, and not unlike other terrorists or would-be terrorists in the past, that something happens that, you know, caused for an explosion, detonation, destruction, whatever, before they had intended, and it takes them out. And it's difficult to say if that was what it was. I mean, it was generally at the right location, definitely caused a lot of damage, but it only killed him, injured a few others, but they had fairly light injuries. You know, they were seen and released from the hospital and didn't, you know, the FBI and others went in there, did a really laudatory job making sure that the embryos, the laboratory where they were being stored was online, still functioning. But there wasn't any great damage to the clinic where all that stuff was happening itself. So it kind of does make me kind of wonder about that. So where were the indications and warning, as we like to say? Where were those pre-incident indicators? If you see something, say something. Where was that out there? And that's a big issue. A lot of this extremism, you see, you'll go back and connect the dots and you'll see where they've visited people. Usually there's not a lot of online stuff, but there's usually some stuff where they've actually talked to people and things like that. But it's, how do we prevent these things from happening? And I'm going to put out a thesis here, or a hypothesis. Well, it's more of a thesis anyway, that if you don't know what you're looking for, then you're probably not going to see it. All right. It kind of goes with the old saying, I don't know where we're going, but we're making great time. And many times I've seen that in the world of terrorism, that we will put a lot of focus on what some may call the usual suspects. All right. Back in the 90s, we didn't understand Islamic extremism prior to 9/11 as we should have. There were some out there who did understand it and were sitting there going, hey, got to look here. Got to look what these guys are doing. A lot of our thinking on terrorism was still tied to the Cold War. You know, a lot of the terrorists in the Cold War were tied to groups that were backed by the Soviet Union or tied to some sort of communist or neo-communist socialist beliefs, anti-Western stuff, very much in that economic, political economic philosophy of communism and extreme socialism, things like that. That was how we kind of viewed that. All right. It's not that we didn't know there was religious terrorism. Certainly we knew that. But there was a lot of it was nationalist-based terrorism. You know, if you look at the IRA, the Irish Republican Army in Ireland, that was very nationalist-based terrorism. So very different model from Islamic extremism. All of a sudden, after 9/11, we started getting a lot smarter on Islamic extremism. But with that, we'd always had this strain of domestic extremism. You know, we'd had environmental extremists. We had anti-government, anti-corporate, constitutionalists, sovereign citizens. Certainly, we had seen the big bombing that took place at the Murrah Building, the federal building in Oklahoma City back in 1995. That right there, you know, you had white supremacist beliefs, you had anti-government, sovereign citizen beliefs tied to that. And we had seen a variety of other things, but we're just not as focused as we were. For whatever reason, it was a lot easier to go after Islamic extremism. And I think some of that is it's a lot easier to go after them. You know, a lot of times if they're different culture, different nationality, in some cases different race, then the preponderance of, say, law enforcement, then it's easier to go after them. And that's been true throughout U.S. history. You can go back to certainly looking at a lot of things. You look at World War II, the internment of Japanese Americans. It's a lot easier many times for authorities to focus on a them, if you will, in that regard. And it's much more difficult if them, this is really bad, but if them looks like, quote, us. In other words, they have extreme beliefs, are very dangerous and stuff. But in other ways, there's a lot of similarities, you know, culturally, in terms of nationality, race, religion, whatever. It makes it much more difficult to focus on that. That is basic human nature. That's just something I want to point out. Now, something else we saw. Washington, D.C., Wednesday, May 21st, at a Jewish museum in Washington, D.C., there was a killing, assassination, if you will, of two attendees. There was actually quite a bit of security at the museum itself, but the perpetrator basically waited outside and basically walked up and killed two people. And it turns out they're both Israeli diplomats. Now, this got everybody's attention, obviously. It got national attention, nationwide attention, a lot of concern overall. One of the things that really focused attention was, for those of us kind of watching this, about a week and a half before, they'd rolled up an Iranian-based cell in the United Kingdom, in Britain, that was focused on doing a big attack on the Israeli embassy. All right. Now in Washington, D.C., that's, of course, in London. Now in Washington, D.C., another big Western capital, all right, you have this basically this attack on two Israeli embassy diplomats. Well, one looks at this and they go, is there a connection? I don't know if I can find a connection on this. This is really kind of an interesting thing. The perpetrator is 31-year-old Elias Rodriguez. It's not clear. He was tied to a lot of different things, but it's just, you know, I couldn't see any connection with him and Iran. Again, I would kind of go back and say, we're going to have to look at his online activity. Maybe he was talking to somebody. You know, a lot of times when you find these violent extremists and stuff, particularly when you say they self-radicalize, they rarely self-radicalize all by themselves. There's a lot of stuff online. And in many cases, they will find, it used to be, they would find a, quote, guru in the real world, that guru would kind of guide them and mold them and, you know, shape their thinking, if you will. If you use the pedophile term, groom them, if you will. In this case, they're grooming them to do some sort of horrific terrorist attack or suicide attack or something like that. Well, we have seen over the last 15 years or so that some of that in-person guru influence has been replaced by online guru influence. And in some cases, it's not even clear if there was an active guru on the other end, or they were simply radicalizing by stuff that had been posted, embedded online, that was basically espousing a very radical, violent belief system or ideology. So anyway, this guy, he went in there, he shot this couple, killed them at the Jewish Museum in Washington, D.C. Very sad situation, because it turns out he was getting ready to take her. He was 30 years old. She was 26. He was getting ready to take her to Jerusalem, where he's from, and he was going to propose to her. And by all accounts, she was probably going to accept and they were going to be engaged. And then this horrific killing happens and they're both struck down, you know, early in life. And it's obviously, is there anti-Semitism? Absolutely. That's the, you know, the choice of the attack. And certainly when he was arrested and he yelled Free Palestine over and over, you get the sense of what the motivation was there. All right. Now, the gun, a lot of times in these attacks, you know, it's interesting. If a terrorist attacks with a knife, you'll hear some condemnation, but it gets real quiet. Why? Because he used a knife. All right. And usually it's a male. If the bombing, you'll hear more. And if it's a gun, it gets a lot of attention because people will focus on the gun and they'll be all over the gun issue here. Yes, but he bought the gun legally. He bought the gun legally in Illinois, a state with a lot of restrictions on buying guns. Chicago, which has one of the highest homicide rates in the country, is probably one of the most restricted cities in terms of owning or buying a firearm. But he did buy the weapon legally. So, and that's happened a lot of times with these shootings, is it's not something where they nefariously got the weapon illegally. It's something they obtained legally, and there really wasn't a lot of complications here in terms of how the attack was. Wasn't an exotic weapon or anything like that. He just walked up and shot these two people, and from what I understand, he shot them in the back. So that's what he did. Now, he had been involved in a lot of activist sort of things. He had demonstrated with reportedly a pro-socialist group in Chicago against then Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, against the city's bid for trying to put a new Amazon headquarters. So obviously there were some anti-corporate beliefs probably embedded in his thinking. He had also protested with a shooting of an African-American teenager by police. So there was some, you know, racial, maybe pro-BLM, Black Lives Matter beliefs in his stuff. But the latest thing is that he glommed on to, obviously, this Free Palestine anti-Semitic tirade, which is huge online. But we've seen it on college campuses and everything around the country as well. And it's believed that some of his anger that may have tied to this was that when he was a young boy, I think about 7 years old, his father was in the National Guard deployed to Iraq. And so there might have been that separation issue that may have manifested itself as well. Anyway, all these psychological things that were going on, I'm sure as more information comes out about this, we're going to find all the things that he was saying. But usually I'm going to say it goes right back to what I just talked about, which is before they're acting out in the real world, they're venting online like crazy in the virtual world. And you got to look at what they're saying, and you got to have the knowledge in order to separate out free speech, protected speech, from stuff that is looks like it's an indication of an imminent threat, you know, public, a danger to the public or a danger to themselves. And by the way, that's codified law. You know, there's plenty of laws in all the states where if they pose a clear danger to others or themselves, in fact, police can literally take them into detention and hold them for a while they do a full assessment of if this person, what level of threat this person poses, and seize their weapons and hold their weapons if they see that. So this is not some radical legal thing I'm talking about. The problem is you got to know what to look for. You got to know what to look for. And then when you see it, it also helps to know how to explain it so that you're getting the right public safety reaction. And I've seen many cases where things did get seen, they did get reported, but they didn't get reported well. In other words, in a way that made people understand that how just dangerous the threat is. And unfortunately, we go back and look at that and we realize, yep, there was a report, but it didn't really do anything. It just sat there. Or the report, in some cases, and I think of the attack at the synagogue in Poway some years back, it was seen on a college campus, university campus, went to the university police. The university police had no idea what they were looking at. And that individual went down and attacked a Jewish temple, a synagogue in Poway. And frankly, when you go back afterwards, you go, there was a lot there that could have been done that could have been used for intervening. And by intervening, what I mean is, if nothing else, going to interview that person. In many cases, those who are on the edge of doing something, if law enforcement shows up and basically says, hey, we know what you've been saying, we know what you've been thinking, We'd like to ask you a few questions and stuff like that. In many cases, it can be sent off in a different direction. It can be derailed or defused, and no attack takes place. The only problem with that is also no law enforcement stats or metrics come out of that as well. All right. A lot of what I'm talking about here is something that got kind of crushed in the great onslaught of standing up the nationwide intelligence fusion centers under the Department of Homeland Security funding. And that was this program called the Terrorism Early Warning, or TEW program. You also heard of TEW groups, or Terrorism Early Warning groups, around the country. It was started a couple of people I know personally. One of them, Dr. John Sullivan, retired LA Sheriff's Lieutenant, started this back in almost three decades ago, back in 1996. They would look at a variety of threats. You know, back in 1996, Islamic extremist terrorism wasn't the dominant discussion at the time. Matter of fact, what really got this going was what we saw in Oklahoma City the year before, which was white supremacist, sovereign citizen, anti-government beliefs. That's really what got this whole thing going. So it actually came from something else. But with that, I got involved with this, oh, I want to say over a quarter century ago, actually when I was still in uniform. And we would look at various different threats manifest themselves, violent extremist threats, other types of threats that were out there. We were talking about cyber threats before cyber was really a huge discussion. We looked at a lot of different things that were going on. And we also looked at natural disaster sort of things, man-made disasters that weren't tied to terrorism, stuff like that. So a lot of different things. Now, one of the problems that we saw with the fusion centers stood up with the best of intentions. Not a lot of great direction or assistance or mentoring from the federal level. It was more or less, in many cases, here's a bunch of federal money, go out and do intelligence stuff. Okay. And it went out primarily into law enforcement. And they said, oh, we know what that is. That's law enforcement intelligence. Which in many cases was, here, great, more money to do case support stuff. So we hire investigative assistants to assist the investigators, and won't that be wonderful? Not the intent. The intent was not to replicate a capability we already had. It was to create or develop a capability that we didn't have, but we desperately needed. And that was 9/11. You know, that was what we saw, which is a lot of indicators, a lot of stuff out there wasn't being assessed. We weren't connecting the dots. We weren't looking at the big threats. We weren't looking at operational intel that well. Case support stuff we were doing. I know. I worked with the counter drug program with a bunch of different state, federal, local law enforcement agencies. We were doing that. That was something already out there. This was something different. And I was a former director of a essentially a joint intelligence center that did this stuff across the board. So I'm not, you know, it's something I'm pretty well versed on as far as how this, what the intent was. And, you know, unfortunately, what came out of it was the thing the TEW would do about early warning, looking at emerging threats and stuff, that just did not get translated over. In fact, if anything, it almost got pretty much weeded out of the program. Or if it did get translated over, it would be distillation of something they were seeing at the national level that would then get kind of turned out at the local level, but it wasn't really that, you know, on the ground regional sort of thing that we were or hoped this thing would turn into. And the metrics didn't match. You know, I started seeing this with the Fusion Center program going back, I want to say, well over 10 years ago, 12 years ago, whatever. One of the problems I saw was if a Fusion Center supported public safety after a big terrorist attack, they would often get a big award. They might become the Fusion Center of the Year award winner, all right? If analysts went in there and supported a big investigation or case, ongoing case, they would get recognition, they get a big award. Well, I always found that a little odd because the purpose of the Fusion Centers was not to respond to acts of terrorism. Their job was to connect the dots to help prevent acts of terrorism. And I found that when you reward something which, from an intelligence or terrorism prevention standpoint, is technically a failure to prevent that attack, you're kind of sending a message. And after a while, that message I could see was received, which is, hey, let's focus on supporting ongoing investigations, just providing case support, and let's focus on what we can do to help them after a terrorist attack takes place. Now, I'm not saying That was a major conscious decision, but people are people, human behavior is human behavior. And that was what that was what was being reinforced. All right. Think about Elliot Rodgers in Isla Vista. We didn't have a lot focused on this new movement called incel, that the involuntary celibate movement. It was growing, had not manifested itself into big terrorist attacks or violent extremism, stuff like that, but it was out there. This is something that I'm pretty sure the Terrorism Early Warning Group, the Terrorism Early Warning Program, would have brought up. They would have looked at that and said, hey, look, this is an emerging threat, whatever, whatever, whatever. And they would have worked hard to get that into the consciousness of public safety, law enforcement, public health, mental health, get that out there saying, hey, you need to look for folks who are espousing this because some of the stuff they're saying online could lead to violent terrorist acts. That wasn't really what's coming out. And certainly after the horrible attack in Isla Vista, in California, up by Santa Barbara, when I look at what just happened in Washington, D.C. with this Rodriguez. And then I look at some of the other things that are out there, maybe, for example, essentially it was almost a class warfare attack at the Borderline Club and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California. I look at the Walmart attack that took place in El Paso, Texas. These were not Islamic extremist attacks. These did not necessarily fit the traditional mold, although one could say El Paso kind of did. Although there's another reason El Paso, and that deals with where the guy came from, that I think that's one of the reasons I got missed. But they weren't doing this. And then, of course, going back to what I talked about last week, then you had stuff which was really, when you get into it, misuse of federal funds tied to terrorism, where you found some stuff very strange. For example, I mentioned the fact that the California Department of Justice, under Attorney General Kamala Harris, all right, under Governor Jerry Brown, and later under Attorney General Javier Becerra and Governor Gavin Newsom, and were putting out training, not just across the state of California, to law enforcement that was being embedded in police academies, law enforcement training academies, as the bulk of their training on terrorism, all right? But it was actually being disseminated through DHS under, started under Secretary Janet Napolitano and President Barack Obama. Nationwide. And this training, and if you looked at it, you go, how did this come from California? That was profiling African-American men as essentially the most likely radicalized domestic terrorists. All right. Didn't say that per se, but it kind of profiled it in there. It profiled a black man being married to a white woman as a likely indicator of terrorism in that overall thing. And then it made some stuff which pretty much profiled or explained Islam, the entire religion of 1.8 billion people, to include Qatar, Saudi Arabia, UAE, where the president recently met with their foreign leaders and talked about how close the relationship is to the United States. Saudi Arabia being the country that has Mecca and Medina, the two holiest sites in Islam. Here in California, they're putting out stuff which basically explains Islam is, in so many words, a terrorist belief system. And this was being put out across the country. And this was embedded in law enforcement training. There's tens of thousands of law enforcement corrections officers in California who have been trained with this, at least tens of thousands, likely hundreds of thousands nationwide. There was a report done by the Southern Poverty Law Center that showed that one of the people very much involved with this was really big in Minnesota. And this is prior to what happened there with the George Floyd killing. And you look at this, you would expect something like this. If you ever see the video, you would expect something like this. Maybe you'd say, okay, Mississippi, Alabama. I actually kind of like Mississippi, but not for this, though. All right. I've done some other work out there in Homeland Security. But you would expect this from some other place in the country, not California. And it was being put out there. And it was really simple, which is it deals with who was behind the production, what was being done, and then the politics behind how they're using federal funds. That is a big, big problem. But it also, if you're doing stuff like that, you're missing the real threat. And I think that's what we saw in this case. All right. Now, in other words, there's a lot that needs to be done. And I would say the first 10 or 15 years, there was a lot of efforts to try and address this. But what we're seeing now is we're missing things more and more. that should not be missed. We're missing emerging threats because we're not doing what the Terrorism Early Warning Group used to do, not taking that philosophy of Terrorism Early Warning to heart, and that's something that we need to fix. All right. Other issues. Ukraine and Russia have agreed to exchange 1,000 POWs. I understand within that mix there were some civilians that were being held prisoner, detained civilians, if you want to call them that, that are part of that. And so that's going over this, over the long weekend of the 24th, 25th, I think going into the 26th. It's a three-day process. It's because this is the biggest exchange they've seen. This came out of meetings between a Russian delegation and Ukrainian delegation down in Turkey that was supposed to be kind of a summit between Putin and Zelensky. Putin called it, said, meet me in Turkey. Zelensky went to Turkey and Putin blew him off. Not only didn't he show up, he didn't even show up, send his foreign minister and sent this lower level delegation. And that was, I think that was a big affront. It was also embarrassing for President Trump because President Trump said, yes, Zelensky, go meet Putin. And he did that. And actually our Secretary of State was in Turkey when this whole thing was supposed to take place. And Trump had said, if Putin comes down to Turkey, he will fly up from the Middle East to meet him. And Putin just blew them all off. Very disrespectful, and it certainly tells you a lot about Russia's interest in ending this war. And let me get into the bigger issues here on Russia and the war. Putin's got a real problem for himself. He started this war thinking he was going to be wrapping it up within a couple of weeks. You know, within a few days, they were going to take Kyiv, and then it was a mopping up exercise taking over the rest of Ukraine. All right? Part of this, and you're seeing this really now, they're very much coming out as their backs up against the walls. They've lost so many men, so much equipment. This idea that they want the legality of the dissolution of the Soviet Union is something that they've kind of redefined, saying that wasn't a legal thing. That should never have happened. And a complacent Lukashenko in Belarus is basically handing over his country to Russia. All right. And they want to take Ukraine by force and dissolve Ukraine. And then, of course, they'll immediately have their eyes on the Baltic states, Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia as the next step. And of course, Poland and Finland are watching this very closely because they know some history there of what the Russians have done. So they're looking at this thing, and Russia has not backed away from this idea of this maximalist thing where they want to take it over. And Putin's economy, his market economy, for whatever it was, has fallen asunder. 40% of the GDP is tied up with military expenditures now. He has transitioned his economy into a war economy. He has drawn down on these sovereign funds and every other source of capital. The petrostate, the oil and gas producing state of Russia, they've lost some key markets in the West, obviously. They're selling oil and gas to China, to a lesser extent India. That's their new markets that they're focused on. But even then, there's a distinct possibility that if not President Trump himself, Congress may force that hand. Apparently, 70 senators right now have signed on to what they call secondary tariffs, which is if you're a country that uses Russian oil, we will put on these massive tariffs on whatever you're doing. I think it's like 500% or something. Basically, it would knock you out of the international market, international global trade, and they're trying to push that through. And certainly Europe seems to be kind of on board with that as well, with that sort of methodology, and that would knock out Russia's ability to bring in the revenue it needs to sustain the war. All of this is going out there, but Putin's stuck. He can't, at this point, they've lost nearly, according to the Ukrainian Ministry of Defense, Russia has lost nearly 1 million men in this war. They have decimated their armor and a lot of other military capabilities. Their Black Sea fleet has been truly, they basically can't operate in the Black Sea anymore. They're going to run out of tanks. They've been pulling old tanks out of mothballs, and they're not very survivable on the battlefield. And by this fall, they're literally going to start running out of tanks. They don't, and what's kind of ironic, considering where things started in this war, is Ukraine has a dominant position with armor right now. So that's a kind of an odd thing to see. So Putin's in a tough bind. And if he gives serious concessions, saying, okay, I'm not going to claim all this territory, I'm not going to do all this other stuff, and I'm not going to poise my forces in a position where we'll wait for a little bit and then we'll invade again and we'll take over the rest of Ukraine. If he doesn't do all that, then politically, he's kind of dead man walking. And that's metaphorical, although within the Russian context, that may be more than metaphorical, because there's a very good chance that he could be deposed. And we've seen where leaders around the world, Ceausescu in Romania, Gaddafi in Libya, sometimes that deposition or deposing process can get rather kinetic, if you know what I mean. And I'll leave it at that. Ukraine is a sovereign country. They can't just give up their sovereign territory. Certainly, they can't make any concessions on sovereign territory that the Russians don't hold, and that's what the Russians want. And they don't, and it doesn't make sense for them to go into a truce or peace agreement where the Russians are poised to simply repeat what they did in February 22. So that's Putin's position. And by the way, Putin keeps putting out this narrative, the Russians do, that the government of Ukraine is not legal, it's unconstitutional, it's all sorts of stuff, and it's just 100% pure disinformation, all right? Now, President Trump made it very clear during the campaign he wasn't thrilled with the war in Ukraine. He doesn't feel that he owns that war because it was something that happened during the previous administration, something he inherited. He thought that he was going to kind of wade into this thing and be able to somehow impose his will to create a peace agreement. Well, that didn't happen. And initially, the U.S. thought, well, the problem is Ukraine. And there's history there. You know, look, the first impeachment of President Trump during his first administration was tied to Ukraine. And part of that was tied to what he felt was an unwillingness by President Zelensky to provide him some things. So anyway, long story short, let's just say that he wasn't particularly pro-Ukrainian, all right? And so he thought he could pressure Ukraine into making some fairly far-reaching concessions. That didn't happen. And over time, I think the Europeans have had a chance to talk to him and explain, no, that won't work. I don't know if the Europeans are having a dominant role in influencing his decision-making process, but he started saying things more lately, indicating that he understands that Putin is primarily responsible for keeping this war going. Although there are times you think that, and then he says something, you go, I'm not quite sure if it's something that has really shifted the entire position entirely. But I don't know. We will see what that is, all right? And then you have what's going on with... But obviously, the U.S. wants to pull back from its commitment in Europe, want to refocus on Asia and the threat of China, and we want the Europeans to do a lot more, and a lot of that's happening in this place. And then finally, Europe is looking at this. They're stepping up. They're giving more support. They're taking a lead role in working with Ukraine on that, which is what President Trump always wanted. And you may not like the way it came out, but it did force the Europeans to step up. They're putting a lot more money into their own defense expenditures, which means they're taking a lot more responsibility in defending their own territory, which is another thing that President Trump's wanted going back to his first term in office. You may not like how it came about, but it did come about that way. And also, the Europeans realized that if Ukraine can stop the Russians cold in that war, it will delay or maybe put off indefinitely any Russian adventurism tied to NATO countries. And so it makes money. It makes cost, I shouldn't say money, but it makes money sense. It's cost effective for them to support Ukraine in fighting the Russians because that's just a smart move. All moral decisions aside or whatever, that's just a smart move on their end. It's to support Ukraine and hopefully create some sort of decisive defeat for the Russian forces. Who knows? Maybe even trigger Putin and his henchmen are being deposed from power and maybe mitigate or remove the Russian threat in that direction, wherever that goes. Anyway, a lot of things, much to consider, much to discuss. And with that, looking forward to, I'm going to take a little break. I got some stuff coming up where I'm going to be unavailable to record a strat this following weekend. But looking forward to recording more, and the world is a fast-moving place. Anyway, thanks for listening to Strat. Go to stratpodcast.com to listen to other Strats. You can also go to YouTube channel, Hal Kempfer TV, or you can go to my website at gripsa.com. Anyway, a lot out there. Thanks for watching and listening.